You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So, tonight we're going to be reading a passage where the Colossians that Paul's writing to have a choice before them, either the good news or what Paul calls the elemental principles of the world. We're going to have to take that apart. We can read between the lines of what he's saying. We can tell what it means. Okay, first, let's go back to last week. Brian Adams read this verse with us about how God canceled your certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us. He took it and destroyed it by nailing it to the cross of Christ. It's a certificate of debt, either a signed confession like an IOU if you owed somebody money, or if you were convicted of a crime, it had the list of your crimes. It could be put on your jail door. It could be put on your bench in a galley where you were a slave. It could be nailed to your cross if you're being executed. So interestingly, it says God canceled our certificate of debt by nailing it to Christ's cross. He took our guilt and made that fall on Jesus. Substitution. Interesting to look at the story of Jesus had a certificate of debt on his cross. We read about it in John 19, where Pilate wrote an inscription and put it on the cross, and it was written, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. Another gospel specifies that he wrote it in three languages, in Aramaic, Greek, and Latin. Well, Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews, and here's a hanging corpse. Obviously, a real finger into the eye of the Jewish people. He didn't appreciate being pressured to kill Jesus. It drove the priests nuts. They came in and said to Pilate, don't write the King of the Jews, write that he said I'm the King of the Jews. Pilate gave a little grin and said, what I've written, I've written. Eat it. And so the irony here is that here on this certificate of debt for Jesus, legally, he was guilty of nothing worse than being the King of the Jews. Not really a crime. And of course, another irony, which is that he really is the King of the Jews. And it was this that is then over, our certificate is laid over his, and it's complete forgiveness. So this is the gospel part here. We read in 15 that in this way, God disarmed the evil rulers and authorities, Satan and his troop. He shamed them publicly by his victory over them on the cross of Christ. How does the cross of Christ disgrace or shame the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places? One of the things you have to understand in the way that Satan thinks is that he casts accusations all the time. He's called the devil, which means the accuser of the brethren. And he claims that God's unloving. But then if you look at the cross, why would Jesus go through all of this if it wasn't for his deep love for us? That's what he claimed, and then he backed it up with action. Satan thinks God's unfair, but Jesus saw that justice was served even if he had to serve it himself. Satan thinks that God is self-serving. How come everyone has to follow him? You know, how come he always gets his way? But would a self-serving God allow himself to be tormented to death like Jesus was? That's not self-serving. The evil one thinks that God's mean. But who was really mean? It was the people that were torturing and killing Jesus were the mean ones. Jesus was the furthest thing from that. And so anyone that understands the cross realizes that these satanic accusations against God are all completely false and canceled out. And so moving on, he says, therefore, don't let anyone judge you in regard to food or drink or in respect to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath day. This is the introduction to this notion of the the Colossian heresy, the false teaching that was going on in Colossae, and Paul calls it the elementary principles of the world. He uses that here. He uses it elsewhere, too. Several times he uses this expression. Colossians right here, just a few verses earlier. See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy, empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world. There it is. Rather than according to Christ. He uses it again later tonight in verse 20. If you've died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as if you're still living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees like do not touch, do not taste, and do not handle? So that's a clue. It has something to do with that kind of thing. Galatians chapter 4, he writes, now that you guys have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how is it that you turn back again to the weak and worthless elemental things to which you desire to be enslaved all over again? You observe days and months and seasons and years. There's another clue. Rituals, religious rites. Yeah, that's what's in view. Edward Norbeck, professor in comparative religion, writes that great religions have indeed arisen as ethical or philosophical principles for the guidance of man, but once they have become the province of the multitudes, they've met a common fate of objectification. That is, of being cast into a concrete form so that they may be actively appreciated by the eyes, the ears, and the other sense organs, rather than remaining as only abstract ideas and beliefs. Yeah, objectification. It's also called formalism. Formalism is when religious people get so focused on the outward forms of religion, rituals, religious rites, holy days, stuff like that. And it's a turning to the outward forms instead of something inward that has to do with the heart and with our spiritual connection with God. And it's a huge problem. These principles, these elemental principles, as Paul calls them, are found in all religion, and they're all remarkably similar. The actions, the motifs, and the beliefs behind them, because they all come from the same source, which is humanity. It doesn't come from God. This is what people come up with when they think, okay, a God or gods are out there, and so we got to figure out how we're going to relate to them. I bet he would appreciate it if I abstain from this food, or if I observe a holy day, and so on and so forth, and they come up with these religious rites, a ritualism, and it's a human creation. It's a religious mentality. You could view it that way. Let's go to our passage. And notice, these elemental principles can come, like in some religions, they're original to the religion, and others, like in Judaism and Christianity, elemental principles might be imbibed and brought in to the faith. You see this in the Old Testament. In Isaiah 29, God complains through Isaiah, this people draw near with their words and they honor me with their lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me, and their reverence for me consists of tradition learned by rote. They remove their hearts far from me. They're not close to me at all. And instead, they have these traditions that they've memorized. And so, yeah, memorized prayers would be another typical elemental principle. And also Christians, same way. And this was happening right here in Colossae. They were buying into this and importing some of this stuff, and often using the Old Testament as a rationale. Let's think of a few examples. Worship services. When we look at this, we're looking at something that is not found in the New Testament, okay? There was something like this in the Old Testament. They had worship services in the Old Testament. And they had a temple, which was different than this temple. Their temple wasn't for going inside. They would have their rituals out in front of the temple. Why are these people wearing robes like that? Because of the Old Testament vestments, the ephah that the priest would wear. And so, it's a form that is, I think, alien to the New Testament. They have various rituals and rites that they perform inside the cathedrals. Here's a more contemporary Protestant version of the same thing. Here's the rock version. Okay, so worship services. Holy days. Now there's something interesting to think about right there. Every religion has its holy days, right? And yet when we come to the way of Jesus, we meet the only one that doesn't have a single holy day prescribed. Oh, later, they were added on. So you have millions of people who never even go to church except for one day a year on Easter. That's the holy day. Yeah, I think that's pretty suspicious. I know as a non-believer, I would look at that and just think, so why is everything different on this day than the other day? You know, that suggests more like superstition. But there's nothing about it in the New Testament. It's devoid of this. We search in vain. The same with holy seasons. How can you not have a holy season? The Lenten season, the Advent season, and every other religion has these times of the year. But again, why would one part of the year matter more than another part? Dietary laws, yes. Super widespread, extremely widespread. Jesus, not a single one. Priests used to exist for a specific cause, which we'll discuss, but then they were abrogated in the New Testament, and instead all believers are like priests, and Jesus is the high priest. So these are just a handful of examples. You could well ask, you know, so what? People want to have Easter Bunny or whatever, you know, let them have their fun. What harm does it do? I think it is harmful. For one thing, these are all distractions from what we're really supposed to be doing. We do have a mission, and we're called to build up the people of God, to invest in our community, and also to proclaim the gospel to people that don't know it. And instead, it isn't that these things are brought in addition to our mission. They're brought in instead of our mission. I used to wonder why we had fish on Fridays in high school. I didn't mind the fish. It was good fish. But then I found out that it was because Catholics aren't allowed to eat meat on Fridays. Goes back to some historical dispute with the fishermen. And so it was a dietary law. They've done away with that now. That's another mark that these are man-made. They don't come from God. Most of them come from the Old Testament, and that's a mistake. That's the problem right there. Let me show you why. Look at Hebrews 7. He's running the argument along and shows that Jesus, the Messiah, is a priest forever, and he replaces any high priest. He's the only high priest for all time. And as a result of that, he says, when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also. So that it's not just the priesthood changed, it's the entire covenant of Moses, the law, and everything with it is set aside, is abrogated, in favor of the new covenant based on Jesus. He explains this. He says, on one hand, there's a setting aside, an abrogation of the former commandment because of its weakness and its uselessness. Yeah, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there's the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. The better hope, the new covenant, the work of Jesus. And so we draw near to God under the new covenant, whereas under the old covenant, there was always distance. You couldn't really come into God's presence. There was a big veil blocking anyone from getting in there. That's the same veil that tore in two from top to bottom during Jesus' crucifixion. God was clearly saying that blockage is no longer there. So, according to the Bible's own logic, we should not be basing things on the Old Covenant. We should not be getting our information from there. In that sense, it's unbiblical. It doesn't follow the biblical line of thought. And we'll see that there are a number of negative implications that these outward forms have toward God. Negative pictures of God. Let's see how this works. Okay, so here we are back in 16. Don't let anyone condemn you for what you eat or drink. So, dietary regulations. You're not allowed to eat that. You're not allowed to drink that. Very common. They're really taboos. You know, why would God impose dietary restrictions? What does he care what you eat? I mean, it's not like he's forbidding you to eat poison or something like that. This is just like potatoes or, you know, meat on Fridays. I don't know. It seems like it's God. What does he get out of this? Why is he holding out a hoop and saying, jump through that hoop? And then holding it out and saying, jump through it again. And keep doing that. It seems like, I don't know what this has to do with a personal relationship. You know, this is a different category than that. What about holy days or new moon ceremonies or Sabbaths? There with the Sabbaths, you can tell, and the new moon, you can tell that there's a Jewish component in this, but it's not all Jewish. Yeah, this is sacred times. Again, how come this time's sacred and that time's not? We say, well, that's celebrating the birth of Jesus. We don't even know what day Jesus died on at all. It's a complete guess. And yet, this is very, very widespread. It kind of seems like you can draw closer to God on these holy days and holy seasons. You know, it's a time of real closeness, more than at other times. And that implication, again, seems like it's taking things in the direction of rules, regulations, and away from the concept of relationship, I think. It's the same with sacred space, which he doesn't mention here, but sacred time and sacred space are both, most churches have something they call the sanctuary. What does sanctuary mean? Sanctus, Latin for holy. That's a holy place. It's literally what it means. And, in my church, you had to be different in the sanctuary. There's no running in the sanctuary. Think of Jesus talking to the woman at the well in John chapter 4. She says, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, but you people say that Jerusalem's the place to where men ought to worship. Jesus says, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. An hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people, the Father seeks to be his worshipers. Yeah, the God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Why would God care if I'm on this mountain or on that mountain when I'm praying to him? Isn't that really kind of odd, eccentric? There was a teaching purpose to Jerusalem, and things went on there that were symbolic. We'll talk about that in a minute, but neither in this mountain nor in that. Why should that matter? And Jesus swept away the idea of sacred space. I think having sacred space, one thing, according to Mircea Eliade, one of the main themes behind marking an area off as a sacred grove or a sacred space is for safety. That approaching the sacred carelessly is dangerous. And that you have to use the gestures of approach as you come toward the sacred shrine or what have you. Yeah, the sacred God is dangerous. It also, it's like we know where we can go and access God. And it's like we got him in a box over here. I can't run in the sanctuary, but I can run as soon as I get outside of it. Or I go to the hospital and a loved one's sick, and then you find that they've got built in there a prayer chapel. It's got the stained windows and the altar. So you can go to that chapel and pray and apparently be heard there in a way that you wouldn't be out on the street or somewhere. So, okay, this brings up the question of where, when he goes on to say these rules were only shadows of the real thing, which is Christ. I'm going to argue that the Old Testament rituals, which were quite a few, were different because these forms were teaching and validating Jesus. You think of, the point of the Old Testament rituals is predicting. They're like my shadow. It looks kind of like me, but it's different. This is the real thing here, not the shadow. And that's Paul's argument. So when we think of the festivals, think of Passover. Jesus was crucified on Passover. It was a prediction that came true. You think of the day of Pentecost. You think of the day of atonement and its picture of atoning for sin. They're all teaching and predictive festivals. And then there's the temple, where each piece of furniture and each act carried out was a predictor of what Jesus' work was going to be. You see the sacrificial system, which perfectly conveys the idea of substitution and atonement, the innocent dying for the guilty, exactly what happened when Jesus went to the cross. And so in that sense, they tell us in advance what the Messiah is going to do. And that, when that came true, well, that kind of validates the whole thing. But at the same time, all of them are now obsolete. All of those festivals, all of those rituals swept away because they're shadows, and the real thing is Christ. So he goes on, don't let anyone condemn you by insisting on self-abasement. Oh, so here now we go. Giving your body a hard time, beating yourselves. You can see entire cities marching in the Middle East and thrashing their backs with chains until the blood runs. Now, why would God prescribe abasing yourself, going on long fasts? One guy named Simon Stylites, as the church drifted heavier and heavier into formalism and this guy and asceticism, this guy ascended a 35-foot column with a platform on the top and lived there for over 30 years. People would journey, take pilgrimages to watch this guy, and they would let him pull up food in baskets. He was a rock star of his day. Simon Stylites. Ask Lord Google. I'll give you a picture of it and everything. I guess if he had to take a dump, he probably just hung it over the side. I don't know. My research didn't include findings on that. What are the implications of that God wants us to be, to practice self-abasement? Is God sadistic? Is this meeting some need in God? Or are we trying to burn away the flesh, as was the case in Gnosticism? If you punish your body because it's the source of sin. Elemental principle. It's not from God. And he says, don't let anyone say you have to worship angels. Well, this part's clearly not Jewish. The Jews had no category for worshiping angels at all. What it is these are intermediaries between people and God. And in later full-developed Gnosticism, we're looking at an early proto-Gnostic teaching here. Aeons, we can go to a basic AI. For a definition, they're divine entities in Gnosticism, extensions of the true God. Aeons are the foundation of the universe, intermediate entities between humans and God. So in Gnosticism, God is too distant to have anything directly to do with us. And so he emanates in layers out, and these layers are the aeons. And they would teach that Jesus is one of those. So a completely devalued view of Jesus. And we don't need any intermediary between us and God because we already have one. There's one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. Yeah. He's our intermediary. We don't need another intermediary. And he goes on, taking this person, taking his stand on visions he's seen. This really stresses no objective verification. Someone says, well, I had a vision, so this and this is the way it is. Really? How are we supposed to know to believe that? What's your backing? Nothing. And so the human origin of these elemental things comes up again. Inflated without cause by his fleshly mind. These religious principles inflate the ego. Why is that? Because first of all, why would people gravitate away from the free gift that God offers us in the gospel toward these elemental principles that are not taught in the Bible? It's because under the elemental principles, I perform. I carry out the duties. I'm holy. I'm a holy man. And Paul goes on, not holding fast to the head. That's Jesus. We saw that back in chapter 1. He's the head of the body. The head, through whom the entire body, being supplied and held together by the joints and ligaments, grows with the growth which is from God. That's what we're supposed to be. That's all we need to be focused on is Jesus. And he goes on further, says, if you have died with Christ to the elemental principles of the world, there's that. Why, as if you were still living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch? So, okay. First of all, this statement, you have died with Christ. Identification with Christ, very heavily taught in the New Testament, and it's our main subject next week. So I'm going to let Bro Adams explain that part to us. But it implies that we're not subject to these elemental principles. So we have, he says, decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. So let's see. Here we're seeing external legalism. A rules-based legalism is trying to approach God based on laws, based on rules. And so a lot of people think of getting to God as like climbing a ladder, where each rung in the ladder is a good work or a religious rite that I follow, a ritual, so forth. And again, people instinctively sense that they owe God, the gods or God something. They sense that they're inadequate, incomplete. And so these are the kind of things they come up with. Maybe this will please God here if we don't ever handle this. Sometimes there's a story connected with them. Often they're just taboos. They make no moral sense whatsoever. They don't seem to have any moral content. And yet people think that's going to benefit them spiritually. The implications? Pretty negative. Very negative. Why would God care whether you drink a Coke or a root beer? You know, I mean, why is he, it kind of pictures God as a cosmic bean counter, leaning over the rail. Oh, you, gotcha. You just touched that thing you're not supposed to touch. And it's that kind of thing where there's a, you know, the mouse trap is set if you're not wary. I don't think God does care what we eat. Again, the Old Testament contained rules for teaching. And then they were all swept away. Mark says, thus Jesus declared all foods clean to eat. It definitely feels like God's not too eager to get together with us. Because again, he's holding out that hoop and saying, jump through that. I'm going to raise it a little bit, jump through again. Keep doing that your whole life and then we'll see. You know, does he love us? Does he want to be with us? If so, why is he requiring stuff like this? How does that help anything? It's religious thinking. 22, such rules are mere human teaching about things that are gone as soon as we use them. And so here's the human origin. This whole thing is man-made. And that's why, even though they're different religions with different beginning assumptions, they all end up looking alike. You think of Buddhism, very abstract, very ethereal. And yet when you watch Buddhists practicing their religion, they're burning incense and putting food on altars and shrines. It looks just like any other animistic religion. Yeah, being man-made. That's a pretty serious critique. Jesus complained over and over again with the Pharisees and scribes of his day, saying, neglecting the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. Their religious system that they had come up with was man-made. It was not from God. So why is it binding then? Why should I trust this group of people instead of that group? And yeah, maybe... one of the heaviest critiques, if not the heaviest critique of all of this is false. It's all false. People could not decide what God exists and how to approach him. It's not up to us. He finishes out saying, such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom. It's not real wisdom, but they can sound very spiritual with their self-imposed worship. So again, we see the human origin of the whole system. And false humility. It's false humility because coming up with your own religion isn't very humble. I mean, you're decreeing the nature of the universe at that point. Real humility is when I yield to the revealed truth from God. And I'm like, okay, my ideas are in the wrong here. I'm going to set those aside and believe what God says in his word. And harsh treatment of the body. So yeah, severe treatment, but harsh treatment too. Think of the prophets of Baal in the Old Testament slashing themselves till the blood gushed out. I imagine my getting a knock at the door and going there, and there's my daughter and her brothers. And she's streaked in blood all over the place, cuts. And she's like, Dad, look what I did for you. You'd be like, what is going on? And what is wrong with our relationship that you would think this would please me, right? And then you can imagine her brother saying, Dad, she worked pretty hard on those. You know, the cuts are deep. I think you show a little more appreciation. I'm sorry. No way. That just makes it worse still. And so we can see the picture, the stoichia to kosmu, the elemental principles of the world, the picture that leaves us with of God is an ugly picture. It's ugly. It's not what he's like at all. Yeah, it raises the question, is God sadistic? Does he get pleasure from watching people suffer? That's what it sounds like. And finally, these elements lack any value in restraining fleshly indulgence. And so they're completely pointless, don't accomplish a dang thing. And so, what have we seen? Basically, for one thing, you can see why Paul was upset that this group of believers was buying into the weak and worthless elemental things. To accept these kinds of principles is really fundamentally to walk away from the gospel. It's antithetical. You saw the gospel when we started, where it's not us that gets tormented, it's God that got tormented. He's the one that put himself out for us, not us destroying ourselves for him. That's a lie. And as long as we're talking about the gospel, what about that certificate of debt? Maybe you're here and you're new, you're exploring things, looking into it. How would you like to get rid of your certificate of debt? You can have it taken away from you and nailed onto the cross of Christ. He's already paid the price. All you got to do is ask him. Say, I want to be included. I want that to happen for me. And boom, that is all it takes. You don't have to cut yourself. You don't have to fast. You don't have to come up even and bow down at the altar. Just come to God in your own heart and tell him, I want to know this forgiveness. And come into my life. And he is delighted to hear that. They say they have a big party in heaven every time somebody believes like that. Awesome. Yes, God, we praise and thank you for liberating us from these elemental principles. And there's no way that we want to go back to that. We're free now, and we just want to relish the freedom of that love relationship with you and just letting you work in our lives. Thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.